I squeeze my eyes shut real tight, little parts of my body go away. I have to do it real slow-like, then in a rush. First, off my fingers go one by one. Then my arms disappear all the way to my elbows. My feet now. Yes, that's right, good. My legs go all at once. Above my thighs is the hardest part. I have to be real still and pull and pull and pull. When my stomach goes away, the chest and neck fall along pretty easy. The face is hard, too. Almost done. Almost. But my eyes is always left. It don't matter how hard I try, my eyes is always left. And I try. Every night I pray for God to deliver me blue eyes. I have prayed now going on a year, but I have hope still. I figure God is very busy, and I am very small. To have something as wonderful as that happen will have to take a long, long time. Blue eyes like Shirley Temple, or Mary Jane on the Mary Jane candies, or Jane in the Primer at school.
That's Bacala Breedlove, from a current production of The Bluest Eye, a Toni Morrison novel adapted for the stage by Lydia Diamond. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Toni Morrison won the Nobel Prize in 1993 for her powerful fiction. Her 1970 novel, The Bluest Eye, asked, in a land that loves its blonde, blue-eyed children, who weeps for the dreams of a black girl? Morrison's tale of young girls struggling to hold on to love and pride in the face of poverty, sexual abuse, and racism hits hard. A young black girl impregnated by her father dreams of having Shirley Temple curls and the bluest eyes in the world. Joining us here in the studio to discuss and sample the University of Wisconsin premiere of The Bluest Eye, which runs through March 15th, are our six guests. Derek Sanders is the guest director of the University Theater's production and comes here from Chicago, where he founded the Congo Square Theater. Sandra Adel is a professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin and author of Literary Masters, Toni Morrison. She's also playing the role of Mama in the current production. Graduate student Jessica Brown-Velez is a dramaturg or researcher for the production. Sherry Williams-Pinnell is the assistant director and playing Mrs. Breedlove. And UW students Olivia Dawson and Dominique Chestend are playing the role of Claudia and Pacola.
Welcome to University of the Air, one and all.
Thank you.
It feels like we have the makings of like a Mormon Tabernacle Choir here. I suppose I should ask first, how big is the cast for The Bluest Eye?
I think the cast is 9 altogether. No, 12. 11. 11.
As long as you know when the time comes.
Yeah. When they get all on stage, we make a move.
And what is the context for it? What is the setting or the time and the place?
We move throughout the South up to the North, where the family settles of the Breedloves. The family of the Breedloves, Pacola is the youngest daughter. In this tale, we focus in on the character of Pacola and her struggles with self-identity and self-fulfillment and her struggles of coming in that age.
And before we get to the current production, the stage version, I kind of want to back it up to the novel itself because I've read the novel, haven't seen the play, and I find it fascinating to even imagine a novel this complex and having this many narrators and points of view and imagery and playing around with language, how that's going to work on stage. Let me ask you, Sandy Adel, since you've taught the novel and written about Toni Morrison, tell us about the novel first and then some of the challenges of taking it to the stage.
The novel takes place specifically in 1941. This is Toni Morrison's most autobiographical piece, and I use that term carefully because it's not about her. What she means by that is that this is Lorain, Ohio, where this is set, is a place that she did not invent. All of her other settings are imaginary. And Jessica has gone and done some research on the background with photos of the locations and so forth. And I did, too, when I was working on the Literary Masters piece, this book, Toni Morrison. I researched the background history of her, not only of her family, but of the time, of the 1940s, and Lorain, Ohio, and how it came to be in the first place. Morrison's father came from the South like everyone else during this great migration that Derek mentioned, because there was work in heavy industry there. In the case of Lorain, Ohio, it was the steel industry. And you know, this is right on Lake Erie. And the factories created these little communities for their employees. And she grew up in a very multi-ethnic community, Toni Morrison did. And it's that setting. But they were poor people. But they had what they needed to survive. And these were very, very tightly knit communities. In fact, in 1970, when the book came out, one of the critics said that Morrison showed tremendous potential, but she could never become the great writer that she could have been with her talent if she only focused on these small provincial black communities. And you know that it's precisely that. She did not deviate from that. And then she's the great, you know, has become the great writer that she is today. So the story then is about these families. It's a coming of age story, not only of Picola Breedlove, but of the McTeer sisters too. And Morrison said that the reason she wrote this book was because she could not find any books anywhere that dealt with little black girls. And her intention was then, I'm going to write the book that I want to read. And, you know, this book has a lot of dark themes in it and so forth, but it also has tremendous humor. And I think one of the things that's happening as we work with, as Derek is moving this from the novel into the play, I mean, as we're working with it as a different thing. And that's the other point I have to make, is that this is a very, very different product now. It's not the novel anymore. And so certain things get interpreted differently. And one of the things we're seeing now, especially as we're on the set, is that there's tremendous humor in this play.
Not just in the narration, but in the situations,
sure,
and in the dialogue.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Jessica, you're the dramaturg, and is there always one of these on board when you're producing a play? Does it have to do with adapting the novel into the play? What exactly is the role of the dramaturg in these productions?
Well, specifically in the context of academic theater and here at the UW, we try to have a dramaturg and do have a dramaturg for every production. That's not the case for all productions throughout the theatrical community. The office of dramaturg, or the role of the dramaturg, is something that is generally said to have originated in Germany, but there's a pretty thriving, or wanting to thrive, community of dramaturgs in this country, some of whom come out of the academic community like I do, and some of whom are sort of more closely involved with production from the beginning.
So do you keep it, what, historically accurate? Do you keep the details in line? I mean, you work with continuity, or how does work?
This is the question, and this is where people tend to go one way or the other. Is the dramaturg the text tyrant, or is it trying to inform the production and create a vision for production that is consistent? And, you know, what can research bring to the production? What can research and academic work bring to the world of the play and to the situation that the play is in? And how can that help director and actor and designer create that world?
And sometimes audience, too, because I've seen wonderful program notes that some of the dramaturgs have done that help for the audience to set the context, explain the scenes, so that as we're watching, we get more out of it. Derek, let me ask you about the playwright, Lydia Diamond. I know she's got another play running right now, Harriet Jacobs, in the Chicago area, but tell us about her and her work on this production, The Bluest Eye.
Well, Lydia Diamond is a wonderful playwright, and I've had the chance to work with her. This is my second production directing for her. I directed Stick Fly, which was an original piece that Congo Square Theater did in Chicago. And this piece she developed as a collaboration with Steppenwolf Theater Company, which a lot of company members of my company were also a part of this production. Lydia is interesting in that she takes an aspect of also the black woman kind of, I wouldn't say necessarily feminist, but necessarily black woman rites of passage. She likes to explore that in all of her work. And it's very interesting because her and Toni Morrison and Lorraine Hansberry kind of echo each other in a lot of similar ways. So when Tony Simotis, the head of the University Theater, called me and he said, you know, I want you to direct. And I said, for the Lorraine Hansberry project, I said, oh, Lorraine Hansberry? Oh, well, Lydia Diamond, let's do her. Because I think she is the modern day Lorraine Hansberry. She's the closest thing that I know in the playwriting field of contemporary that is like Lorraine Hansberry. Her play Stick Fly, and also the one that's stepping off right now, Harriet Jacobs, is all resounding on the same theme, and that is the history of Black women and also the rites of passage that they've gone through in their lives. And I think that's what she echoes a lot in American culture in her work.
So what do you think you give up when you go from this novel, The Bluest Eye, to the stage? I mean, is there like levels of irony in the narrative or all kinds of attitude that you have to translate somehow?
Well, it's one of the things, and I think the dramaturg and Sandy will have some great insight on this. But what I had to do as a process is I read the book once. I read the book once, and then I set the book down. And I said, okay, I have to stay true to what Lydia did. Because what Lydia did, this piece is only 90 minutes. And this play has a wealth of characters and a wealth of insight and a wealth of narrations and stories that cross each other and diverge off into other places. I mean, like any great novelist does, they give you great detail. And if we did that, we would probably still be in the theater.
hours and hours.
So it's up to a playwright, and the genius of what Lydia Diamond has done is that I think she has synthesized the work into its purest form, into the purest form of what the story is about. And I think in terms of what I've done is I've taken Lydia's work and I interpret Lydia's work. I go back and forth between, you know, and it's great having Sandy in the room. It's great having a dramaturg that you can lean on, because I go back and forth between what were Lydia's choices with the book and what was Toni Morrison's choice and what is our choice in telling this story. So I always want to be true to the author. And in this case, that's Lydia is the playwright. And then the author, Toni Morrison, and what her intent was, I also consider. So every now and then I look over to Sandy and I go, now, what happened in the book? What happened in the book? Because I don't try to commit that to memory, because then I'll be trying to tell a story that is unlike what Lydia has chosen to tell. I don't know if Sandy or Jessica can speak on that.
Well, I think that in the process of adapting the novel into a play, what we have to really keep in mind is that those are two separate genres. And although the stories are very similar, in fact, identical in a number of ways, they are two separate works of art. And so the work that Lydia Diamond does as a playwright in taking that huge story, that rich and detailed story, and transferring it into something that is also going to be rich and detailed, but in a physical way and not in a literary way necessarily, in the same way that the novel is, reflects that difference between the experience a person has in reading the story and the experience an audience member will have in watching the play. It's similar, but it's a totally different experience, and it needs to be a separate story. It needs to be its own story and stand on its own feet.
The book is what? And it's a fairly short book, too. Five different narrations, five different narrative points of view. How do you cope with that when you get to theater?
Well, it's a little bit more than that in the book. But I think in the theater, what we've done is she has a kind of a marathon of passing batons of narrators, mm-hmm. and different narrations, and they go in and out. It's more of a Rio dynamic in terms of telling the story. And by that I mean is that I can be a character and yet I can be a narrator at the same time. They exist on the same plane.
And that's a fun device theatrically.
It's particularly fun in this play, because you get to not only be in the scene, but you get to comment on the scene as the character. So it provides a lot of humor and a lot of tender moments, I think, in a play.
One thing the novel does is to open with sort of telling you the plot, the tragedy, mm-hmm. right out. You know, it says, quiet as it's kept, there were no marigolds in the fall of 1941. We thought at the time that it was because Pecola was having her father's baby that the marigolds did not grow. Mm-hmm. They're looking at the barren earth and wondering, is it somehow related? In the play, mm-hmm. in Lydia Diamond's version of it, how does the play open?
Oh, I can't spoil it. but this is a great time to go into that little section, because I have a selection that Olivia, who's playing Claudia, is going to read that section. I would love her to read it and then talk about it.
Quiet as it's kept, there were no marigolds in the fall of 1941. Not even the gardens fronting the lake showed marigolds that year. We thought, at the time, it was because Pecola was having her father's baby that the marigolds did not grow. We had dropped our seeds into our own little plot of black dirt, just as Pecola's father had dropped his seeds in his own plot of black dirt. The seeds shriveled and died. Pecola's baby, too. There is really nothing more to say except why. But since why is difficult to handle, one must take refuge in how.
And then we're jet-propelled straight into the story.
And what are we seeing on the stage as those words are being said?
We're seeing the two sisters, Claudia and Frida, kneeling over this plot of dirt that they planted these seeds, almost as if it is a burial site or a grave site in memory of Pecola.
So, flashback, is that mainly what this play is about?
We flash back, forward, sideways. In this play, and then the next step, we immediately flash back to when they first meet Pecola, and they, the question, I think it's set up beautifully from Lydia, and it said, since why is so difficult to answer, the next question is how, and we show you how. And I think what this place points out more than anything, other than it being like a one incident kind of this father who has sexually abused his daughter incident, is more about the community and how the community and everybody in the community had a hand in this little girl's destruction. Everybody in the community had a hand, and in some way, we were all responsible for this. And in some ways, in some small ways, in some big ways, and some ways that weren't even noticed, and some ways that were very intentional. But in some parts, I think everybody had a little bit in kind of filtering that negativity into the spirit of this little black girl.
Do Morrison or Lydia Diamond get into what makes the perpetrators the way they were? I mean, do we take it back yet another level?
Yeah, we definitely go into that. I guess, Sandy, you should talk a little bit about that, about the book. But, I mean, we definitely get in, and that's one of the things that I've been exploring in particular, because you have so few images of black male interaction in this play that it's very important that we understand the character's motivation. I think Lydia done a great job in trying to balance all the two. And it's not one side to blame, but there's many sides to this coin.
And Sandy, can you comment about Charlie Breedlove?
The father.
The father.
Yeah, let me say simply that one of the things that, and I'm going back to the novel, that Morrison's narrator in the novel, or the voice that's filtered through, the voice that filters or stands in for the author does, is sets up the conditions of Charlie's birth and life in such a way that the narrator simply comments on it, just throws the facts out, and it's like the narrator steps back and says, I'll let you decide for yourself whether these conditions or these situations in any way explain his behavior. And I let you decide whether you're going to sympathize with this person or not. She doesn't judge. And I think that's very important as readers. And I want to back up and also and talk about the idea of intentions. Because in literature, when I teach a novel or talk about fiction, I say that, we cannot determine or guess a writer's intentions. Because once the book is out there, it goes through this interpretive process.
It belongs to everybody.
So, it belongs to everybody. And that it doesn't matter what the author's intention is. It's a very different situation, though, with the playwright. There are specific intentions there that have to be respected. In other words, what's called the given circumstances of the text.
And it comes out different every time.
It comes out different every time, but the framework that he set is based on what, in this case, the playwright intended, not what Morrison intended. So that's how you get this removed. And that's what I'm finding very fascinating. But to return to the point with Charlie is that, as he said, it's precisely because of this character and what this character does, that the scenes have to be dealt with very carefully. And then there's the other daddy. So there is a balance. And I think that Morrison, when she wrote her novel, was aware that if I'm going to put up this character, I've got to do something over here too.
So she shows you a family broken apart, but also a family that is loving and is embracing at the same time. More on The Bluest Eye when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. For more information about corporate sponsorships, visit wpr.org. /underwriting.
Precious Lord, take my hand and lead me on and let me stand.
The Breedlove's ugliness was a unique kind of ugliness. Mrs. Breedlove and Pecola wore their ugliness, put it on, so to speak, although it did not belong to them. You looked at them and you wondered why they were so ugly. You looked closely and could not find the source. Then you realized it came from conviction. Their conviction. It was as though some mysterious, all-knowing master had given each one a cloak of ugliness to wear, and they had each accepted it without question. The master had said, "You are ugly people." It was a truth, supported by every billboard, every movie, every glance.
Yes.
They had said,
"You are right."
And they took the ugliness in their hands, threw it as a mantle over them, and went about the world with it.
That's a scene from the current production of The Bluest Eye, a Toni Morrison novel adapted for the stage by Lydia Diamond and running through March 15th at the University Theater. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we have many guests in the studio from that production. Derek Sanders, you're directing the play. Can you tell us about what is occurring when we hear that? You have the song going, and then the character of Claudia, who in the book is often the narrator, is speaking.
What's really going on is interpretation of a feeling that's present in the book, and a feeling that you get of the history of these people, as well as the history of the neglect and also self-image that you feel. Is not necessarily in the book that way, but it is compounded with ideas and imageries of Toni Morrison that's been concise into. That's the perfect example of how imagery has been concise into like a 1 minute segment.
Mm-hmm. One of the passages that I always remember from the novel itself has to do with dolls. You know, just the way Claudia, the person that we heard there, right. Played by Olivia Dawson, the Claudia likes to dismember the white dolls, you know, take them apart, and the grown-ups are so shocked with her. On stage in this production, are there, I mean, do you work with the dolls?
How many do you go through?
Well, that's interesting.
It.
I mean, yes, that's in the play. And yes, I think that's one of the most sickening kind of fun monologues there are in the play. And I think those are one of those echoed of a lot of children across the world and a lot of people who, kids who break toys and destroy them. But this is done with a particular kind of fervor. And I think it really kind of taps in Toni Morrison's emotion. And as Sandy said earlier, is that it really kind of taps into how personal this is for her. You can really understand when you hear this monologue and when you hear it in a book and when you read it in a play that this is a personal experience, that this isn't just a character offshoot. This is very personal, and it comes off in extreme emotions and complex ideas of breaking down why this black girl tore into these white dolls. And it's funny, too.
I want to add with that, when he talks about this being a very personal experience, there is a certain generation of women who, we didn't have choices in baby dolls, and that's all we got. And in the book and in the play, there is this whole bit about Dancing with Bojangles. And I know how I felt as a little girl watching Shirley Temple dancing with Bojangles, and I'm never, ever going to get a chance. And I don't know if this is a feeling universal of people coming up that at that age, but certainly when Derek talks about this being a personal experience with Toni Morrison, it is a collective personal experience of black girls who grew up in that time. Because where was the image of a black doll for us? There weren't any. And so this is the only thing that we were told that we were supposed to look like. We endured all kinds of torture with our hair, getting our hair turned into Shirley Temple curls because that made us pretty, you know, with the hot curlers and so forth. And so Shirley Temple looms in our collective imagination as this little girl that we were never going to be, because that little girl was white, for one thing, and she was created by Hollywood.
Well, and I read that a recent study was done that echoes the results of the Brown versus Board of Education experiments with dolls, that black girls today still are choosing white dolls as more beautiful, and I mean, some of the damaging self-esteem is still there. What are you doing with this production that you would say will hit audiences of 2008 as very relevant? I mean, Toni Morrison's novel from 1970, the play set in 1941, but we're in 2008.
I honestly believe that the rites of passage of a young girl haven't changed very much. The onslaught of images for teenagers and young people is unparalleled to what it was. I mean, a lot more people listened to radio back then, a lot more people read back then, but the onslaught of images, over 500 and 600 channels that you can get instant images across your cell phone all day, every day, is an onslaught to children and to, I think, young women across the world. That's why I thought this play was particularly important. And I've been particularly fortunate to be working with some not only talented actresses, but very intelligent actresses who bring a lot to the table and bring a lot of their experiences to the table. We talked about specifically the doll thing at the table, and we explored those things. I am a man, and I haven't experienced those things. I have two sisters, two older sisters, so I went through those things with them. But these things, this rite of passage for a woman, I think is universal. And I think those things have not changed. And those images that they have to love themselves and find out how to love themselves. I think the difference is in today's society, as they say, in teenagers, the plastic surgery rate is going up dramatically. So it's all in these ideas that they want to be perfect. They want to change who they are. Just like this little black girl wants to have blue eyes. They want to have bigger breasts. And now you can actually do it. You can actually change your eyes to blue. Mm-hmm. Or you can actually get those bigger breasts or get those fuller lips. That wasn't possible until, I guess, last 10, 12 years did it become popular now. And now you're finding out that girls for high school are getting plastic surgery. In high school, your body hasn't even developed yet, you know. And I think it's direct response to all these images, these onslaught of images that the kids are getting in the media.
It sounds a little bit as if, though, that what you're describing, the ability to change yourself, would actually be at odds with the message in this play, which is more like learn to live with yourself and love yourself as you are.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point in the play, and I think that's exactly what they should get. The ability to change yourself is at odds, and I think she takes this one girl and she becomes almost an icon now, you know, iconic figure to the example of people who want to change their self throughout the culture and throughout this. So when you have young kids, older kids, and people who have come up in a different society, a different time, who understand that wanting to be somebody else, wanting to have the blonde hair, wanting to have the blue eyes, wanting to have, it could be simply, you know, I want fuller lips. I want to be what's fashionable. And that is at odds with every point that I think Toni Morrison is making into play. It ultimately ends in the destruction of this little girl.
Let's talk about the character of Mrs. Breedlove. Mm-hmm. Can you describe her and the way her attitude toward, for example, the white adult world affects her treatment of her own daughter?
Oh, wow. Mrs. Breedlove is a wonderfully complex character. And she kind of deconstructs every emotion that happens to Pecola on some level. She thinks herself to be ugly. And in that thought of herself of being ugly, she becomes more and more ugly inside and also outside in appearance. She goes to the movies and she sees the movies of Jean Harlow and stuff. And she even has a point where she tries to become these actresses because she loved the movie pictures, but she became disgusted with herself because she felt like she could never become that. And in turn, that was her happiness. And being in these theaters, in this dark theater, and looking at these images. And that became her happiness of kind of hiding her own self away and not having a strong self-image. But yet, what Toni does so great in the book and Lydia does in the play is that this is a character that is a strong woman. she's a strong woman. Strong woman in a lot of ways, you'll see in the play. And strong woman in a lot of ways, but she has a strong self-protective of herself. She thinks right or wrong, you know, has a strong line of how she should be treated and how she wants to be treated. But she also has a lot of internal disgust with her own beauty image. And the next scene that we're going to see is a discussion, kind of a parallel of Mrs. Breedlove's and Pecola's kind of internal disgust of each other, themselves.
I went to the hospital when my time come. Didn't want to have it at home. They put me in a big room with a whole mess of women. Them pains was coming, but not too bad. The doctors come to examine me.
Please, God, make me invisible. Please, please, please.
One old doctor was learning please, the young ones about babies. Please. When he got to me, he said, now these here women you don't have any trouble with. They deliver right away with no pain, just like horses.
Amen. If I squeeze my eyes shut real tight, little parts of my body go away. I have to do it real slow-like, then in a rush. First, off my fingers go, one by one. Then my arms disappear all the way to my elbows. My feet now. Yes, that's right, good. My legs go all at once. Above my thighs is the hardest part. I have to be real still and pull and pull and pull. When my stomach goes away, the chest and neck fall along pretty easy. The face is hard, too. Almost done. Almost. But my eyes is always left.
Only one of the doctor students ever looked at me. Looked in my eyes. I looked right back at him. He dropped his eyes and turned red. He knowed, I reckon, that maybe I weren't no horse foaling.
It don't matter how hard I try, my eyes is always left. And I try. Every night I pray for God to deliver me blue eyes. I have prayed now going on a year, but I have hope still. I figure God is very busy, and I'm very small. To have something wonderful as that happen will have to take a long, long time. Blue eyes like Shirley Temple, or Mary Jane on the Mary Jane candies, or Jane in the Primrose School.
I see them doctors talking to them white women. How you feel? Gonna have twins? Nice, friendly talk. When them pains got harder, I moaned something awful. They weren't as bad as I let on. But I had to let them people know that having a baby was more than a bowel movement. I hurt just like them white women. Just because I wasn't hooping and hollering didn't mean I wasn't feeling pain. They think just because I know how to have a baby with no fuss that my behind wasn't pulling and aching like theirs. Besides, that doctor don't know what he's talking about. He must never seed no mare foal. Who say they can't have no pain? Just because she don't cry? Because she can't say it, they think it ain't there. If they look in her eyes and see them eyeballs lolling back, see that sorrowful look, they'd know. Anyways, the baby come.
And people would have to be nice, and the teachers would see me. They would really look at me in my eyes and say, look at pretty-eyed Pecola. We mustn't do bad things in front of those pretty eyes. Pretty eyes. Pretty blue eyes. Big blue pretty eyes. I would be very happy. Like Jane and Shirley and the candy girl.
She was a big old healthy baby. All big brown eyes and hair. A right smart baby she was. I used to like to watch her nurse. You know they make them greedy sounds when they nurse. Eyes all soft and wet. Like a cross between a puppy and a dying man. But I know she was ugly. Head full of pretty hair. But Lord, she was ugly.
They are very happy.
We have two points of view here. Clearly, you've got one woman who's very self-assured, not only with her own worth as a person rather than a horse, and then even extending her sympathy to horses, but also even willing to accept ugliness, you know, in the child. And then on the other hand, of course, you have Pecola, who is totally giving herself over to the opinions of others.
Right, right.
Does the one really have a positive influence on the other by the time the bluest eye is over?
No.
That's why I've heard it said it's an oppressing play. Yeah.
You know, I want to say also that the experience that Mrs. Breedlove is having, this is a poor black woman. That experience of birthing would have been the same experience that Mrs. McTeer had, you know, because these people were not in the so-called black middle class where they could have their own physicians and so forth. So what she's describing is what just about all the black women in her community who were very poor, that's the experience of birth that they would have. That would have been the treatment that they would have received from the very racist doctors that they, you know, that took care of them. And this is what Morrison does in the novel, though. She doesn't say that. That's an unstated historical fact. But what Morrison does there and what shows up in this play are two very different outcomes. They're contrasting outcomes.
Yeah.
And one of those have to do with the fact that even, you know, we love our ugly babies too, by the way, when we have them. But the other part of it is that there's domestic sphere. Mrs. McTeer does not work outside of her home. She has a husband who works and takes care of her and the family. Picola's mother has to leave her home and go and take care of somebody else's children in a space that she's never going to own or have anything similar to. And there were studies done, and there's research that shows that those women who were taken out of their homes, who went out of their homes to work in someone else's homes, often displaced the love and affection that they had for their own children onto these other children.
I have an adult student that I'm working with right now who said that when she went into labor in Evanston, the hospital refused, because she was black, to let her give birth there. She had to go to Cook County. And I think what you hear in that Mrs. Breedlove monologue is, I don't know, the struggle against that double standard, the double measure of worth of any human being.
The bearing up under it.
Yeah. But at the same time, she has her own self-loathing. And we talked a little bit about how that balance, somebody who can be so prideful about, you know, I want to get the same treatment as the white women, but at the same time, don't think internally that she's as pretty as any of them, you know? So, I mean, it's very complex, you know, the layers that we're getting. And I think we have a brilliant cast. We have brilliant actresses that are doing fantastic jobs with the roles. And it'll touch you. You know, I mean, it's not just a depressing play.
No,
it's one of the, you'll run through the gamut. It's a lot of joy and a lot of life in the plays. And it's intended for kids 6 and up. It was written as a youth production. It was commissioned as a youth production.
Really?
So it's really intended for, even though the book is a lot more mature, the play itself is intended for kids as young as 6.
Well, we're going to find out a bit more about the impact and the implications of The Bluest Eye when we return in a moment. This is University of the Year.
PortalWisconsin.org lists almost 1,000 cultural events in Wisconsin. Find out which ones you want to see at PortalWisconsin.org. Portal Wisconsin is a service of Wisconsin Public Radio and the other partners in the Cultural Coalition of Wisconsin.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guests, all of whom are involved in the ongoing University Theater production of Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. It runs through March 15th. And our guests include the director, Derek Sanders. Also with us is UW Professor of Afro-American Studies, Sandy Adel. And we have also dramaturg Jessica Brown-Velez, as well as actors Olivia Dawson, Dominique Chestand, and Sherry Williams-Pannell. We were talking just a moment ago about the internal conflict having to do with beauty, self-concept, and how low Pecola's self-concept is in this, influenced largely through her own perceptions by, you know, advertising ideals, the Shirley Temple ideal, let's call it, which gives her this low self-image. What we haven't gotten into is lowering of self-esteem through external judgments. How much of that do we see in this play?
It's not touched on as hugely. It's usually just in moments and ideas. But in the next scene that we're going to show you, it shows you a very clear incident where the racism has a direct effect on Pakola Sahi. So let's see that.
Sometimes when I get all the folding and ironing done for Mrs. Breedlove, I go on a candy adventure.
Seemed like a simple enough thing, only nothing simple for Pakola Breedlove.
I walk down Garden Avenue. I mostly look at things on the sidewalk and wonder. I wonder why pretty yellow dandelions is called weeds. I like them. They strong and grow fast and don't hurt no one. When I look hard enough, I sometime find a penny. When I have three, I put them in my shoe. This sidewalk a good one for skating. I don't have skates, but I think because it is old and smooth, the skates would go over it real nice. There's a crack shaped like a Y that I trip over most of the time. The ants go into that crack, and I think they must have a whole world under there that makes some kind of sense to them.
Pakola pulls off her shoe, takes out the three pennies, and climbs the four wooden steps to the door of Yakubowski's Fresh Vegetables, Meat, and Sundry Store. Mr. Yakubowski stands behind the counter and looks, but doesn't really see Pakola.
Hello, Mr. Yakubowski. He doesn't say nothing to me. Like he can't even hear me.
It's a total absence of human recognition. A glazed separateness right behind his eyes. Pakola has seen interest, disgust, even anger in grown male eyes. But this vacuum has an edge. An edge of distaste that lurks in the eyes of all white people. The distaste is for her blackness, because what else could it be? It's right there, in his bottom eyelid.
It's the one image that kind of goes directly to the onslaught of kind of racism of the time. And, you know, strangely enough, that's one of the things we had to talk about a lot, you know, just in terms of the limitations that people had. I think it's a sign of the times, which is a good sign, I think, that some of the students and some of the people, we had to really kind of explore to them and say, you know, really, you wouldn't be allowed to do this. And in this situation, is really where you'd be able to go into this store. So we had to explore the history behind that and how does it affect all the community of this play. And it's talked about a little bit in different ways, but mostly it's about self-image and how racism affects self-image.
Well, and that opening image of the marigolds that can't flower in the barren soil, mm-hmm. it does kind of call our attention to the environment and the effect that would have.
Exactly.
If you are born into a place and a time, you sometimes can't flower, you can't bloom in the way you were meant to.
On the other hand, she thinks, what is it, the dandelions? These weeds. Yeah. Who says they're weeds? I always thought they were pretty myself.
Yes.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
But there's actually another kind of aspect to this racism, too, in this scene, is that is actually she's transparent in a way. She's not even there
exactly.
as far as he's concerned.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know in Australia, it's still an Aborigine culture. You know, it's still the Aborigines in Australia are still thought of as kind of like, it's invisible people. There's no kind of racism there because they don't even recognize that they're there. So it still exists in society on different levels. And I think in this time frame, that image really is really powerful. You know, Lily does a great job of putting that out there.
So what is it like playing these characters?
Let's start with you, Pakola.
I would have to say it's very difficult because playing this character forces me to address a lot of issues, a lot of insecurities that I've had for years that I've chosen to ignore. And being in this production forces me to face them and not only take them and realize them myself, but put them out there for the audience to see.
Gosh, isn't that kind of what acting's all about?
Yeah.
But it hurts more when it comes to this issue, when it comes to a racial issue. It hurts more than it would if you were playing a character where everybody can relate, regardless of what race they are. But with this, where it's like so specific, and you have to go to these memories that you've experienced simply because of the color your skin is, it hurts more. It just, it hits a deeper spot within you.
And I hear the difference in your voice when you're talking as you, as Dominique Cheston, rather than Piccola, this child. Being a child, you have to do that as well. The Claudia part played by Olivia Dawson, what's that been like?
It's interesting. It's an interesting journey. But I've had the benefit of doing two previous productions where I had to play children. So I kind of got a running start at it. Claudia is, like Derek said, she's the griot of the piece. And so at times she's a child, but at the same time she's omniscient. She sees all and she can comment on it. But she lives it at the same time. And it's kind of a slippery slope, you know, and I had to navigate. Now when am I omniscient? When am I a child? And she's this quasi kind of, I don't know, all-seeing, all-knowing character. And that makes it very challenging, made it challenging for me to try and find out who she is. But it's been a good journey. You know, I've never played a character quite like this. That's neither, was it foul nor, what is that phrase?
Neither fish nor fowl.
No, fish nor fowl. She's like this in-between area. And I think this play touches on, it touches on a level so deep because it doesn't talk about black and white. It goes into those gray areas that none of us wants to touch or explore. And Claudia lives in that area. So it's challenging, and I'm having a good time with it, actually.
And then we have Sherry Williams-Pinnell, who you're serving both as the very complex Mrs. Breedlove, but also as assistant director of this production.
Mm-hmm. And I want to clarify, there are two of us who serve in the capacity as assistant director, and Talish Barrow is really the number one, and I'm number two on this, and I've had the privilege of watching the process of Derek Sanders and being able to comment from time to time, but mainly to be a presence as a resource, particularly when blocking those scenes that delve into the very darker places that have to do with very sensitive issues. So being there to provide a support for the actors who are involved in those scenes.
Do you have to adjust, or do you feel the urge to adjust this play at all depending upon audience reaction? Does it affect your timing, you know, your interpretation, the flow of this piece?
No, I'm pretty specific about what I want, you know, out of the piece. And I think it's very clear from Lydia, from my conversations with Lydia, you know, what she expects out of the piece. And I try to take those to heart and try to put those in there. And I think overall she wants an entertaining experience that also teaches a lesson and an emotionally engaging experience. And I think all my actors and all the people who have been a part of this process have been very brave in facing these conversations and this very difficult book, but very majestic. It's a very majestic book and a majestic topic. And I think it's one of the great literary works of our time. And to be able to work on it is a privilege for me. And to be able to be with such smart, brave actors who are willing to provide a fantastic story has been one of the highlights of my career, I have to say.
Would it make you nervous to know that Toni Morrison was in the audience some night?
Yeah, I think I'd just go home. Couldn't stand that too much.
Yeah, well, you just never know, do you?
Yeah, you never know.
Well, Sandy, speaking of Morrison, let's take it back to Morrison, the author. You've taught the novel as a novel. You've got the play and have been in the play, taught the play. Can you talk about the experience of going from the novel to the play and then back to the novel? When you next teach The Bluest Eye as novel, will you approach it any differently after being in this play?
Absolutely. It's a total different experience for me now, because with the direction that we're given and seeing this on stage, some of the monologues, some of the speeches, some of the interactions between the characters have clarified things for me that were in the book, but I wasn't quite sure of it. So I would approach it very differently now. We talked earlier about moods. When Sherry sang Precious Lord and then Olivia started the Claudia monologue, that's a mood that you can't grasp in the book. And this is one of those instances where we have to make the separation between what's in the book, the novel, and the play. But those instances, that mood, makes me rethink the certain scenes in the book itself. So I would certainly, when I go back to teach this, it's going to be a totally different experience, teaching experience for me.
And if you look at play or novel, either one, to make it Toni Morrison's Bluest Eye, What has to be there? What are sort of the essential themes, the sort of take-home message, the thing that has to have it there in order for this play and the novel to sort of be?
But the play's not Toni Morrison anymore. But we talked earlier about intentions, and there are certain intentions in the book. There's a certain framework that has to be maintained. It has to be, this space has to look like Lorain, Ohio, or some Midwestern city, because the place is not named in the play. But it's Lydia Diamond's adaptation now, not Morrison's. And that's one of the things that I, as a professor who has written on Morrison, had to think about. And it was very clear to me after the second day of what we call table work, and that's where we're sitting reading and discussing the play, that I have to empty my head of everything that I thought about in terms of the book, because this is a different thing. This is a different product. Yet, by the same token, when I go back to reading, to teaching the novel, it's all Morrison. I won't be referencing Lydia Diamond anymore. And I want to point out also that there were things in the book that I thought long ago. Mrs. Breedlove's monologue that we heard, for example. I would read that out loud and I think, this is a monologue. This sounds like theater. Mm-hmm. And then when I was researching a book called Literary Masters, Toni Morrison, I found all this information and material about her being in the Howard Players in the 1940s. She was an actress with this very famous, theater company within Howard University. It's one of the historically black colleges. And that's where black actors train. They didn't have anywhere else to train. And so here she was, playing Shakespeare and all the classics. I have a photo of her as Queen Elizabeth in Richard III. And suddenly something clicked, and I said, that's why this book seems so ready to go on stage. Her other texts would be very difficult to adapt, but she's closer to her own experience when she wrote this in 1970. She was closer to her own experience in the 1940s, of being an actor. And so that monologue is taken almost verbatim from the novel, is a classic, theatrical piece. And this is why I think that Lydia Diamond chose to, and Morrison had to agree to allow her to do this, to adapt this. This is perfect for the stage.
And it lends itself to theatrical work then.
It does.
I've heard Toni Morrison comment that the closest thing to her novels is actually African-American music, jazz.
Mm-hmm.
In the play, The Bluest Eye, is there any element sort of the blues or of music that gets brought across?
It is through Derek's insights and directions and the sound designer. So there's a bluesy theme running through it. But in terms of jazz, her most jazzy book, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of her technique in writing, is the book, the novel titled Jazz.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us for University of the Air for this hour. It has been a fascinating look behind the scenes of a fascinating book, The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, which has been adapted by Lydia Diamond for the stage and is a current university theater production. We've been talking with the director, Derek Sanders, and with Sandy Adel, and with other members of the cast, as well as the dramaturg. A pleasure having you all with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Break some legs. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Be sure to be with us next Sunday afternoon at 4 for University of the Air as Christopher Taylor joins us at the piano with insights into what it takes to perform all 32 of Beethoven's piano sonatas. That's next Sunday afternoon at 4, University of the Air, here on Wisconsin Public Radio.